We've already started the GM Foods exercise. You did parts one and two. Of course, we don't really know the answer yet. We don't know whether the food you tested is genetically modified until we do the electrophoresis next time. But today we don't do any of the lab stuff. We are we'll have this slideshow, and then we'll have another flick. So let's talk about genetically modified foods. Now, genetically modified foods, of course, are simply genetically modified organisms that we eat. We don't genetically modify things only for food. We do it for other reasons. But we do genetically modify quite a bit of foods nowadays. Plants, specifically. For some reason, we have less of a social problem accepting genetic modification of plants compared to animals, whether or not that's justified. But anyway, GM foods can be either transgenic or cisgenic, so you have to remember what those words mean. What would a transgenic food be?
Like an example?
Not an example, no. What does it mean? Right. Well, a different species of plant might be cisgenesis. Transgenesis would be a totally unrelated organism that you're getting the original gene from and then putting that into the plant. And that happens quite a bit. So the plant is not only genetically modified, it now has a gene and therefore is able to make some sort of protein that no plant has ever been able to make naturally, because that gene evolved in some totally unrelated organism. But you can also transplant a gene from one type of plant into another type of plant, or a closely related plant, which would be cisgenic. That's the only difference. As far as how it's done, they're done exactly the same way. So remember that the actual gene that it gets transplanted into the recipient organism is called the transgene. And we don't do this just for fun. The reason that you put a transgene into a plant is for some reason that makes sense. In other words, to give some advantage to the plant that it would have, that it wouldn't have if it didn't have that transgene. And these are just typical examples, not the whole list, but pest resistance means that with the new gene, the plant will not be killed by certain plants by certain pests that normally attack that type of plant. Which means, therefore, that you wouldn't have to use things to kill the pests. The plants would have their own resistance to the pests. Can also have tolerance to herbicides. Herbicides are chemicals that kill plants, right? Well, if you make the plant that you're interested in growing, the GM plant, if you make it immune, in a sense, to the herbicide, then you can use the herbicide to kill the other things that are competing for those plants. In other words, to kill the weeds without killing the crop. Delayed ripening of fruit, pretty self-explanatory. Why would you want delayed ripening of fruit? So that it doesn't go bad while it's being shipped to the market. It ripens sometime after it's picked, longer than it normally would, giving you time to get it to the stores so that it's perfect when you buy it. Improved yield simply means making a hell of a lot more of that than the natural plant would. So either, you know, bigger ears of corn, more ears of corn, whatever.
I was reading this piece online, and it was saying that McDonald's, like...
This porn?
Huh?
Porn?
No. It was saying that McDonald's, they take, like, the chicken or whatever, and, like, they make it fatter.
Right.
Is that, like, genetically...
Well, not actually fatter. They make it heavier, but it's not fat that is put onto it. It's more meat. We do this with turkeys, too. I mean,
yeah.
Turkeys have ridiculously big breast muscles.
Is that genetically modifying the organ?
It's interfering with their mating, so it qualifies as biotechnology, but it's not because we're transplanting genes into them. And yet, at least.
And is them doing that to them bad for us?
Well, it depends on how it's done. Depends on whether it's for chemical reasons, simply breeding them, and it also depends on the human who eats it. So it's part of the controversy. Yeah.
I was going to say, yes, it's bad for us. Example A.
It's bad because we want to eat even more. Bad for the animals that we're eating, you're saying?
Yeah, it's bad for the animals because they can't grow, they can't walk, they can't do
it. Yeah, it's definitely bad for them. Of course, it's bad for them to just... They're going to die either way. But yeah, the lifetime that they... I agree. They should be given a humane lifetime before they're killed. Because they don't know they're going to be killed. Increased or improved nutrient content, self-explanatory, right? The nutrients that foods have are because of the genes they have. So if you give extra genes to foods, they can make... The composition of that food is going to change. So that's another reason. Damn it, I forgot my thing. Didn't I?
Yeah. Well,
that's part of the controversy as well, because if you genetically modify plants so that they are resistant to herbicides... Then that means you can use herbicides more so than you did before, because you're not going to kill your plants, you're going to kill all the other plants, but that's going to expose those weeds to herbicides over a long period of time. They might develop resistance, just like overusing antibiotics is going to cause antibiotic resistance in bacteria.
Well, there has been an issue with
Right, and this is, and super weeds as well is what you'll read about if you read about the controversy of genetically modified organisms, creating these super weeds that are resistant. All right, let's go to slide 2. Damn it. Oh, no power at all. Well, that explains that. All right, I'll have to go old school. So creating a genetically modified crop is an expensive and complicated deal. Doesn't happen easily. There's a lot of steps, and each step has many problems associated with it. So this can take more than a decade to produce, and therefore 10 years or more of spending money to get it done. So first of all, you have to identify a useful gene. Identifying it simply means noticing it somewhere in some organism. So some organism produces some sort of protein. Well, the reason it's able to make that protein is because it has a gene that codes for that protein. And so you might think, well, that would be a useful thing to have in a plant, even though it's not in a plant at the time, perhaps. So a good example of this is a gene from Bacillus thuringiensis, which is just abbreviated as BT. And it's capital B, lowercase t, because we always capitalize the genus and we never capitalize the species name. Thuringiensis is the species name. Well, anyway, this bacterium has a gene in it. You know, that's its natural gene. The gene, though, codes for a protein called delta endotoxin. And that endotoxin kills pests that bore into plants. They drill into the plant and eventually kill it. There's several different pests that do this. But these pests that bore into plants are killed by endotoxin. So the idea here is take the gene out of the bacterium, put it into plants that we're trying to use for food, and then even if you do have the pests there, they won't be able to kill the plants because that gene was going to give the plants resistance to the pests. All right, so identifying it is the easiest part. That doesn't really take any work other than observing. But identification and location are two different things. Identifying it simply means this organism has this gene somewhere in its DNA. That doesn't tell you where in the DNA it is, though. So once you identify the gene, you have to locate it within the host's genome. The host is the organism that naturally has that gene. And the genome is the whole set of DNA that an organism has. So your genome, for instance, is spread out over 23 different kinds of chromosomes. Well, a bacterium only has one chromosome. It's a lot less DNA to work with. But it's still, you know, there's many, many thousands of nucleotides in that DNA. And you have to find which nucleotides actually make up that gene. All right. If you finally locate it, or once you do locate it, then you have to isolate the gene. All right? So it's not enough to find it. You have to have a way to cut that gene out of the bacterial chromosome so that you're working with just it. You don't want to transfer the whole genome to the plant. You want to just transfer the one gene that you're interested in. So as you see there, the coding portion, which means the DNA nucleotides that make up the gene itself, which serves as an instruction, that could be hundreds or thousands of base pairs for some smaller proteins, but it depends. There are some genes that are tens of thousands of base pairs. Or even more. Now, if the transgene comes from a bacterium, like in this example, then it's an easier process because bacterial genes don't have anything in them called introns. But eukaryotic genes, so if you get the gene from anything other than a prokaryotic organism, those genes will include sequences within the gene called introns. So if you have a gene represented just by this double strand of DNA, that's just part of the overall chromosome that you're taking this thing from. But this includes the gene. Well, there will be segments of that gene that are called exons, if it's from a eukaryotic organism. Some of these will be called exons. Some of these things will be called introns. Exons get their name because they are expressed, meaning they are used to make the protein. Introns get their name because they are intervening, meaning they come between the exons. But they are not going to be used to build the protein. So this is introns are kind of like pages of the manual for how to build the protein, pages that aren't needed. So they need to be torn out. And then the exons need to be put together to make the final version of the messenger RNA that is going to be used to make the protein. So this is an extra step. This is an extra bit of complication because in the gene, well, I shouldn't I shouldn't imply that the DNA gets cut. It doesn't. The DNA gets made into messenger RNA, right? And then the messenger RNA has exons and introns. The introns from the RNA get cut out. And then the exons get spliced together. There are special RNA and protein complexes in eukaryotic organisms called spliceosomes. That take care of this job. A spliceosome literally means splicing body. So spliceosomes know, since this is a gene that naturally occurs in that organism, the spliceosome can recognize the messenger RNA that includes both the exons and the introns, snips out the introns and sews together the exons to make a shorter piece of messenger RNA that's just the instructions itself. Then that goes on and gets read by a ribosome to make a protein. Well, if you're taking a gene from a eukaryotic organism to put into the plant, that gene's going to have sections in it that correspond to introns. Those can't be allowed to remain in the gene. So you have to not only identify the gene and isolate it, but then you have to identify the introns in that gene so that you can experimentally take those out so that they're not a problem in the plant. So that's what the first bullet point on slide 3 is. You have to modify the transgene by removing the introns, which means you need to know where the introns are, which is not an easy task. But assuming you are able to recognize the introns, then you need to remove just those introns and leave the exons intact and sew all those little bits together to make an intact, intron-free gene. Okay, that's a lot of work in itself. But even that gene that you've gotten rid of the introns for is not going to work in the plant. Even though the genetic code is universal, the gene is not going to work in the plant unless it's recognized by the plant. So when you have a chromosome, which is a long stretch of DNA, there are genes in it. That might be one gene, this might be another gene. But there's a bunch of DNA between genes. These are so-called non-coding regions. And so that DNA is either just junk DNA that does nothing, or it somehow is involved in controlling the genes themselves. But whatever the non-coding DNA is doing, it's not being an instruction for how to build a protein. So the organism needs to know where the genes are. And it knows where the genes are because of the location of promoters. Each gene has a promoter, which is just the very first part of the gene. But the enzymes that transcribe genes, the enzymes that read genes and build messenger RNA, are able to recognize these promoter regions. So if you put a gene into a recipient organism and it doesn't have a promoter, it will just be viewed by that organism as junk DNA. It doesn't realize it's a gene. So you have to put, even after all this work of getting the introns and all the introns out and sewing together the exons, you also have to put a promoter at the beginning, a promoter specifically that the type of organism you're putting this into will recognize, because there are different kinds of promoters. And so there's different possibilities, but the most widely used promoter for plants that are going to be used for genetically modified foods is a promoter called CAMV35S. Now, the CAMV is short for cauliflower mosaic virus. So this is DNA that makes up a promoter that is naturally found in cauliflower mosaic virus. It's a viral promoter. But cauliflower mosaic virus is a virus that attacks plants. And remember how viruses reproduce. They can't reproduce on their own. They're not organisms, right? They reproduce by injecting their DNA into some sort of cell, and then that cell transcribes that DNA and translates the mRNA into protein to make new viruses. Well, the virus has evolved a promoter that works well in the plants that it's taking advantage of. So we're taking advantage of the fact that the virus has already done the job of evolution to create a promoter that works very well in plants. And therefore, we use that promoter, not with its normal gene that it's connected to. We just take the promoter out of the virus and then hook it on to the gene from whatever other source that we want to work in the plant. Okay, then we have a complete gene. Well, actually, it's not complete just with the promoter. You also need something at the other end of the gene. The promoter is the beginning. You also need a terminator, which tells the recipient organism where the gene ends. It needs to know where it begins. It needs to know where it ends. The promoter is the beginning. The terminator is the end, as the name implies. And a very popular choice of terminator. Once again, you could use multiple terminators. But one that's mostly used in this country is one that's called nopaline synthase, or the NOS terminator. NOS is short for nopaline synthase, and that comes from a bacterium, Agrobacterium tumefaciens. Now, the nice thing about these promoters and terminators is that the promoter, which comes from a virus, has evolved to work very well in all cells of a plant, not just certain types of cells. Plants are like us animals. They are multicellular, so they have different kinds of cells, right? Well, we've already talked about the fact that different kinds of cells within the same organism use different kinds of genes because they need to make different kinds of proteins. So genes will be turned off in some types of cells that will be turned on in other types of cells. Using this CAMV35S promoter means that that gene is going to be turned on in every kind of cell within that whole plant, which is what you want if you're genetically modifying it. And then the NOS terminator works very well in plants as well. And that's because it naturally evolved to work in plants. These bacteria, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, are bacteria that attack plants. And we've talked about them before. This is one way how we use this bacterium. I talked about it when we were talking about plasmids, to transfer plasmids from the bacterium into the plant. All right? So constitutively transcribed here means always turned on. Constitutive means continuously being transcribed. So every cell, since all cells in that whole plant are going to have the same DNA, every cell is going to have that new gene. And since it's constitutive, that gene is going to be turned on regardless of what kind of cell it is. Okay, now, at this point we have a gene that is from some organism. It could be from anything. That's one organism, though. Then we use a virus, which isn't an organism, but it's another source of DNA that we use for the promoter. And then a third one, a bacterium that we get the terminator from. Three sources contribute to making this one gene that we then put into a fourth organism, the plant itself. Now, slide 4 is a picture that summarizes transcription. And you've already had this exact slide, I think, right? The three steps of transcription, remember, are initiation, elongation, and termination. Well, in a genetically modified organism, transcription is no different for a gene that's genetically modified. The plant doesn't realize that gene wasn't there to begin with. It's a gene that, since it has a promoter that is recognized by the plant, that plant will transcribe the gene. And that's the whole reason why you have to put the promoter on, because if the gene that you put in does not get transcribed, it doesn't do any good. You'll never make the protein that you're trying to make. But this shows you the promoter as being the very beginning of the gene, and that egg-shaped thing is the RNA polymerase enzyme, which is shown in greater detail here. That's the enzyme that actually reads the gene, and according to the sequence of DNA nucleotides, it makes a complementary sequence of RNA nucleotides. So if it sees A, which would normally call for T in DNA, right? It's going to make a U because RNA doesn't use T. A C will get a G, a T will get an A, and a G will get a C. So that's how this red messenger RNA molecule is produced, by reading the DNA, the gene itself, and transcribing a complementary sequence. So that's going to happen whether the gene is naturally there or not. Its transcription occurs normally. Elongation simply means adding nucleotides one at a time until you get to the terminator, in which case you're done. And therefore this completed RNA transcript can then go to a ribosome. Ribosomes are the organelles of translation. And what happens during translation? It's reading what?
The RNA is read and made into a protein.
Right. Translation is when the protein is actually assembled. So the gene has the original information. That is used to make a messenger RNA molecule, which is now carrying the code. And then translation reads that code and makes a polypeptide or a protein using the code. And so that's why, if this is a transgene, all of a sudden this plant is making a protein that it never was able to make before because it didn't have that instruction. Okay, if you get through all of that without any problems, which is years later because of all the complexity, then you have to remove some cells from the recipient or parent plant. It's not really a parent in the natural sense because it's not reproducing naturally. But you take a sample of cells. And remember a while ago I said that I gave you a definition of totipotence? What was that?
A cell that can change into any other cell.
Right. Totipotence is the quality of being able to produce any kind of cell in that organism type. Plant cells have totipotence. So basically any cell from a plant acts kind of like a stem cell. That's why you take some cells, and once they're removed from the plant, they basically start acting like stem cells, and you can start growing them in a dish. And that forms what's called a callus, which is just kind of like a plant tumor. It's just a mass of undifferentiated cells. But that gives you some cells to work with now. Then, using one of several methods, the three most popular are shown up there, you take the gene that you've so carefully engineered and put it into the cells, at least one of the cells in that callus. All right, so there's three major ways that can be done. A process called electroporation, which is named for the fact that voltage is applied to the cells. It's electrical. And giving those cells this voltage makes the membrane of these cells much more porous. Makes them temporarily leaky, in a sense. But you're not interested in having things leak out. You want little holes to be formed in the membrane temporarily so that that DNA can make its way into the plant cells. That's what electroporation is. There's also a device called a gene gun, which is just what it sounds like. A tiny little gun that shoots DNA into cells. And that usually doesn't work, but you do it enough times and you get lucky every once in a while. Or you could use a bacterium to do the job for you. Specifically the one that I talked about in a previous slideshow and just a couple slides ago. Agrobacterium tumefaciens. So this is the same bacterium that you've already gotten a terminator out of to design the gene. If you're going to use that bacterium to also do the job of getting this new gene, the transgene, into the plant, then you have to put that transgene into a plasmid, like we've talked about in the previous slideshow, and then transform the bacterium, meaning I'll make that bacterium take up that plasmid, just like we're going to have our E. coli take up P-glo plasmids, and then you let that bacterium do what it naturally does, which is to infect plant cells. In this case, the plant cells are the callus cells, the ones from the plant you're trying to get to be transgenic. And the agrobacterium will transfer that plasmid to the plant. But since you've designed the plasmid, that plasmid now has the gene that you're interested in getting into that plant. And so now the callus cells will have that new gene. Either one of those three methods will work, but you choose one of them and you go with it. And like I said, most of the time something goes wrong, but that's why you just keep doing it over and over, and eventually you can become successful. Now, I already talked about markers when I talked about plasmids originally. Markers give you a way to know that the gene has been successfully taken up by the plant in this case. So you could use a gene for antibiotic resistance as a marker. You could use some sort of visual marker like green fluorescence protein. So this is a separate gene that you're not transferring because you're so interested in that. You're just transferring this marker gene so that you can tell whether the other gene that you are interested in got transferred successfully. Because this callus, which is a group of cells, most of those cells in the callus are not going to be receiving the gene. Only a certain number of that population of cells is going to receive the new gene. You need to be able to tell which cells of that callus received the gene. That's why you have a marker. Okay? Everyone good so far? Slide 6. Assuming everything goes right up to that point, and you have at least some cells in your callus that are transgenic, then you need to isolate those transgenic cells, which you can do because they have the marker gene, so you can tell them apart. You get rid of the ones that did not receive the gene, so you're working only with transgenic cells, and then those are treated with plant hormones, which causes them to develop into a whole plant. But since that plant started out as a transgenic cell, every cell that's going to be in that plant that it grows into is going to have exactly the same DNA, right? Because that's how plants make multiple cells, by copying the ones they already have. Well, if the ones they start with are transgenic, containing the new gene, then that means your entire plant is going to be now transgenic. In other words, you don't take a whole plant and try to put the DNA into each of the cells of that plant. You start out with one cell and grow it give it the gene and then grow it up into a mature plant. So now you have one plant that's entirely transgenic, if everything went right. And now you can back cross it with a plant, a natural plant, that has the highest yielding crop. So your best performer, basically. You cross it with one that is now transgenic in the hopes that you're going to produce a plant, an offspring plant that are both transgenic and high yielding. All right? And then you can keep back crossing them to make them even more and more pure, basically. So, like I said, this can take 10 years or more easily to get through all these complicated steps. And all of the expense that that takes is part of the reason why the companies doing this are eager to make sure those plants are actually used, right? If you go through all the expense and then don't use it, it's going to be a waste of many, many millions of dollars. So that's part of the politics of it. That's why, that's part of the controversy. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Is that also why some companies want, try their hardest to reject, laws and stuff that force them to, label?
Exactly. Crops? Yes, exactly. And that's also why companies that spend these billions of dollars to make these plants, that's why they also spend a lot of money to make sure that farmers don't plant anything else. They basically try to force growers into using their genetically modified organisms so that there's a payoff.
Should the company be taking the crop instead of the actual product?
Yes. Yes, if things were fair. But it's not, it's a controversial subject. But anyway, that we're doing this with a lot of plants. We haven't been genetically modifying animals for food yet. Although that will certainly come, I would think, unless there's too much public outcry. And there is beginning to be more public outcry about genetically modified foods, because more and more people are starting to realize that they've been eating genetic modified foods all along, or not all along, but recently, where they didn't know it before. So anyway, this experiment that we're in the middle of is basically a test to see whether some plant, your test food, is genetically modified. And that's what we're going to be doing the next time. So I just want to tell you something about the one of the things that we're going to be using next time. Instagene matrix. Well, actually, we've already used this stuff. Sorry. I just want to explain. I didn't tell you what Instagene matrix does or what MasterMix does. I want to explain that to you so that you understand what you've done so far going into the electrophoresis next time. So the Instagene matrix, as you see, a suspension of negatively charged beads, tiny little beads. That's why the stuff was so thick, right? It didn't really drip. It just stayed in the bottom of the tubes. It's a hell of a lot of tiny little negatively charged beads. And the reason that they're negatively charged is because they are acting as chelating agents. Chelating agents are things that bind to positive ions. And the reason they bind to positive ions is because the chelating agents, these negatively charged beads, are negative. Negative and positive attract each other. The reason that's important is because positively charged ions, and specifically, mostly, magnesium ions, which are Mg2+, these magnesium ions are necessary for certain enzymes to be activated. So if you have the magnesium ions there, these enzymes will be activated. And these are enzymes that you don't want in this experiment to be activated, because these enzymes are nucleases. Nucleases that are made by the food itself, naturally. Okay? But a nuclease is not only an enzyme, it's an enzyme that specifically breaks nucleic acids apart. DNA is a nucleic acid. So nucleases will ruin the DNA, basically, if the nucleases, the enzymes, are activated. It's magnesium that activates them. So if you can get magnesium out of the picture, then the nucleases will not become activated, and your DNA will not be destroyed. Okay? That's why Instagene Matrix has these chelating agents, to make sure that your DNA does not get destroyed. Now, you don't want those beads, though, to be in your PCR tubes. And that's why you centrifuged those tubes before you then took some of the supernatant, the stuff floating above the beads, to put into the PCR tubes before you gave it to me last time. But you didn't give me just that pure stuff, right? You took the supernatant after you centrifuged. You took the stuff that's floating above it, and you added it to one of two types of master mix. You had a red master mix and a green master mix. Well, here you have to think back to how PCR works. We had the slideshow on PCR. And remember, you have to have primers in your mix that are looking for the beginning and the end of the piece of DNA you're interested in amplifying, right? So that's the one of the things that was in the master mix. So there's two kinds, two sets of primers. The green master mix had primers in it that looked for what is called a photosystem gene. All right? A photosystem is a complex of proteins that are in plants only, or are in photosynthetic organisms only, I should say. So we don't have them, for instance, because we can't undergo photosynthesis. But all plants can. And therefore, regardless of what type of plant you have, it should have photosystem genes in it. And that's why you have primers in the green mix to look for photosystem genes. It's a way of saying, you know, if the primers do find it and amplify that DNA, that's a way of saying, yes, you definitely did get DNA out of the plant. Because it's not enough to just look for genetically modified DNA. If you look for genetically modified DNA and you don't find any, yes, it could be that your plant is not genetically modified, but it could simply be that you didn't get any DNA, period. Right? To be definitive in answering the question of whether the food was genetically modified, you have to be able to show that you did get DNA out of it, but that DNA is not genetically modified. Well, the way you show that you did successfully get DNA out of your plant is by looking for something that every plant DNA has, and therefore it should get multiplied in the PCR process. That's what the green stuff did. The red master mix looked for something, DNA, that should not be naturally in any plant. And specifically, it was looking for that CAMV35S promoter and for the NOS, or nopalin synthase, terminator. In other words, it's looking for exactly the things that we use to put foreign DNA into plants. That's a way of making sure that you have, I mean, that's a way of demonstrating that the DNA you have found is genetically modified. Okay? So the green master mix is looking just for plant DNA, period. The red is looking for genetically modified DNA. And in both kinds of master mix, red and blue, you also have nucleotides, which are the building blocks that you use to build the new DNA in each step of PCR, right? Specifically, the nucleoside triphosphates that we talked about. You also have the polymerase that we talked about that gets the job done, and dye so that you can tell them apart. Now, next time what we're going to do then is electrophorese it, and that's why we needed the PCR. Unless you have enough DNA in each well that you put into the electrophoresis gel, you're not going to see a band even if the DNA is there. So we put it into the thermal cycler so that we would have a hell of a lot of DNA and therefore have nice distinct bands. And we'll look at the electrophoresis when we actually do it. We'll look at the gels when we actually do it next time. That's the rationale for it, though, or that's the rationale for what we've done so far, and we'll talk more about it when we actually do the electrophoresis. For now, take a short break, then we'll watch the movie.